Welcome to the History of Little Europe, Episode 1.12, Warriors for Hire. Last time, we watched as the Swiss Confederation burst onto the world stage with smashing victories in Italy, France, and Burgundy. In this episode, we will watch as the Habsburgs begin to get more assertive in their attempt to curtail the rise of the League. Now, by the time of the Burgundian War, the Confederation stood in a position analogous to that of a powerful, free imperial city. As long as the emperor's nominal rights were not enforced, all went well. But Maximilian, in his attempt to reorganize the empire, erected in 1495 an imperial chamber which had jurisdiction in all disputes between members of the empire. The Confederates were unwilling to obey it, partly because they could maintain peace at home by their own authority, and partly because it interfered with their practical independence. The Habsburg Emperor then established the Swabian League, a collection of southern German territories, which was formed as a check against the Swiss in all but name. There was hope that an institution similar to the Confederacy could bring it to its knees. The Swiss were offered a chance to join the League, but the strict control of the Emperor within it made conflict inevitable. The occasion on which conflict broke out was the seizure of territory in the Graubünden, or Grey Leagues, a southern territory aligned with the Confederacy, which is today unique for its Romansh-speaking population. The Habsburgs attempted to seize a tract of land along the Umbrial mountain pass, further consolidating their control over it. But the Grey League's alliance to the Confederation, and the Swabian League's status with the Habsburgs, soon brought those two parties into conflict. The struggle lasted several months, the chief fight being near the Calvin Gorge, in which one Benedict Fontana, a leader of the Gotteshausbundmen, performed many heroic deeds before his death. But, both sides being exhausted, peace was made at Basel on the 22nd of September, 1499. As this was a conflict between two members of the empire, the situation was referred to arbitration by the recently established council, but the emperor annulled all the decisions of the imperial chamber against the Confederation. The reason for the change of heart is unknown, but some have suspected that at this point the emperor realized that it was better not to keep trying and have them declare independence. Nothing was laid down as to the Confederation's future relations with the empire. No future real attempt, moreover, was made to enforce the rights of the emperor, and the Confederation became a state allied with the empire, enjoying practical independence, though not formally freed till 1648. Thus, 208 years after the origin of the Confederation, in 1291, it had gotten rid of all Austrian claims between 1394 and 1474, as well as practical subjugation to the emperor. But its further advance towards the position of an independent state was long checked by religious divisions within and by the enormous influence of the French king on its foreign relations. With the object of strengthening the northern border of the Confederation, two more full members were admitted in 1501, Basel and Schaffhausen, on the same terms as Freiburg and Soleure. The city of Basel had originally been ruled by its bishop, but early in the 3rd century it became a free imperial city. Before then, it had made no permanent alliance with the Confederation, though it had been in continual relations with it. Schaffhausen had grown up around the Benedictine Monastery of All Saints, and became in the early 13th century a free imperial city, but was mortgaged to Austria from 1330 to 1415, at which point the Emperor Sigismund declared all Duke Frederick's rights forfeited in consequence of his abetting the flight of Pope John XXII. It brought its freedom in 1418 and became an associate of the Confederation in 1454. A few years later, in 1513, Appenzell, which had in 1411 become a protected district, and in 1432 an associate member of the Confederation, was admitted as the 13th full member, and this remained the number till the fall of the old Confederation in 1798. Around the three original members had gathered first five others, united with the three, but not necessarily with each other, and then gradually there grew up an outer circle, consisting of five more, allied with all the eight old members, but laid down by certain stringent conditions. In the first years of the 16th century, the influence of the Confederates south of the Alps was greatly extended. This time period is known as the Italian Wars, wherein the various European powers of the Pope, the Habsburgs, France, and the House of Savoy duked it out across the Italian peninsula, and the Swiss were clearly eager to get in on the action. Throughout this time, the French made various attempts to gain Milan, which were largely carried on by the help of Swiss mercenaries, some of whom were on the opposite side. But, as brotherly feeling was still too strong to make it possible for them to fight against one another, Lodovico Sforza's Swiss troops shamefully betrayed him to the French at Novara. In 1500, the three forest districts occupied Bellinzona at the request of its inhabitants, and in 1503, Louis XII was forced to cede it to them. He, however, often held back the pay of his Swiss troops and treated them as mere hirelings, so that when the 10 years' treaty came to an end, Matthew Schinner, Bishop of Sion, induced them to join the Pope, Julius II, then engaged in forming the Holy League to expel the French from Italy. But when, after the Battle of Ravenna, Louis XII became all-powerful in Lombardy, 20,000 Swiss poured down into the region around Milan and occupied it. Felix Schmid, the burgomaster of Zurich, named Maximilian, the son of Ludovico, Duke of Milan, in return for which he ceded to the Confederates Locarno, Valmaggia, Mendrisio, and Lugano, while the Grey Leagues seized Chiavenna, Bormio, and the Valtellina. In 1513, the Swiss completely defeated the French at Novara, and in 1515, peace was sent by Henry VIII of England to give pensions and get soldiers. So that was a lot of names in rapid succession. Slowing it down, the Swiss had just taken advantage of the French incursions into Milan to rush in, proclaim themselves the defenders of the Italians, and kick the French out. All of this would not last long, though, as France soon received a new king, Francis I. He, immediately after his ascension, began to prepare to win back the Milanese, and, successfully invading the Swiss, awaiting his descent from the Alps, beat them in a pitched battle at Marignano near Milan, which broke the Swiss power in northern Italy, so that in 1516 a peace was made with France. The Valais, the three Raetian leagues, and both the abbot and town of St. Gall were given to the side of the Confederates, in exchange for them rescinding all other claims throughout the rest of northern Italy. Provision was made for the neutrality of either party in case the other became involved in war, and large pensions were promised. This treaty was extended by another in 1521, by which the French king might, with the consent of the Confederation, enlist any number of men between 6,000 and 16,000, paying them fit wages, and the pensions were raised to 3,000 francs annually to each member of the Confederation. These two treaties were the starting point of later French interference with Swiss affairs, a tradition that would continue and climax during the French Revolution. So, in the end, the French went into Italy, overextended, and the Swiss came in. Then, the Swiss overextended, and the French came in. In the end, neither won Milan, but both annexed a series of towns on their borders. Believe it or not, this is now the last bit of international politics I will be covering until we talk about the Protestant Reformation. Basically, from this point to the French Revolution, the Swiss borders will remain constant, with the exception of the western frontier. The Italian, Austrian, and German borders will remain constant for nearly 300 years. But I want to take this time to step back and talk about what the Swiss were doing, other than being caught in a massive battle over the state of the Catholic Church. Because it turns out, the Swiss had figured out a pretty sweet gig for themselves in the middle of all this expansion. I hinted at it just a minute ago, but the key to the longevity of both the state and economy of the Confederacy was its soon-to-be-thriving mercenary industry. As it turns out, all those times the Swiss had trashed foreign armies, they had not only asserted themselves, but forged a reputation. Time and time again, it seemed like vastly superior numbers went up against under-equipped Swiss militias, yet the Confederate forces always came out on top. People took notice of this, and before long, Swiss troops were a hot commodity. Especially as the Confederacy became involved in fewer international conflicts, the stable supply and rising demand forged an industry practically overnight. Every king, prince, and noble wanted a Swiss detachment, many after finding themselves on the receiving end of one. Even out of their natural alpine climate, the Swiss mercenaries proved to be incredibly effective on the field of battle, where their valor, strength, and endurance changed the outcome of countless battles. And this was especially good for the Confederacy for two reasons. First, the mercenary industry in the late Middle Ages was incredibly stable. Since the rest of the Swiss economy was just a bunch of alpine cattle farms, the money this brought in was enough to kickstart the rise of merchants and industries in the major cities. But second, it kept all of the men of any fighting capability far away from the nation itself. Of course, this leaves you vulnerable to attack, but as we have mentioned, very few are keen on trying that by now. And not having a professional army breathing down your neck is incredibly stabilizing. Their paychecks are already secure, and there is rarely enough of them in one place to gain momentum and foment rebellion. Every other state went through countless uprisings, revolts, and rebellions, but the Swiss enjoyed a stable lifestyle on the back of a stable industry. And soon, this stability became another asset for the Swiss to use to their advantage. But I digress. That still leaves one obvious question, though. What made the Swiss so good at fighting? Well, there's been almost no talk about this, and the only mentions of it chalk it up to the Swiss having a lot of experience. But for a nation with ever-rising neutrality, that seems unlikely. I would like to propose a different solution. I think the Swiss were so good at their jobs, at least in large part, because they were born in the Alps. As any Olympic athlete can tell you, training at altitude is an absolute must for any endurance-based activity, as the thinner air prompts the human body to increase red blood cell count, improving stamina. The Swiss, naturally, enjoyed the full extent of this, especially when you consider that the Alps are practically the only range between Spain and Romania. And the historical testimony seems to support this. Generals would often default to putting the Swiss on the flanks, where their superior endurance would keep the battle line stable. Of course, this is one man's conjecture, so take it with a grain of salt, but I think it is an interesting idea to consider. The rise of the Swiss mercenaries would have two additional effects that must be mentioned. First, as described in a past episode, the weapons of the Swiss made them incredibly effective against cavalry, and as their influence spread, the knights of the medieval age began to fade. For the first time since the classical era, the most effective position on the battlefield could be poorly equipped infantrymen. Second, the Swiss were seen as such good fighters that several heads of state selected them to be personal bodyguards. Of these, two are worth mentioning: the French Swiss Guard, who are infamous to those who have studied the French Revolution, and the Pontifical Guard, who to this day are the security detail of the Pope. Tourists will no doubt be able to recognize the bright uniforms they wear, but in fact, the Swiss Guard still functions as a full security operation. In addition to the symbolic guards, there are real troops in the area with snipers and roadblocks, and they are all natively born Swiss. Join us next time, when the newly independent Switzerland becomes embroiled in a very messy conflict over the Catholic Church that would split the country in two. Until then, share the show, rate the show, subscribe to the show, send me emails at historyoflittleeurope@gmail.com, and until next time, Bozek Nanya, ciao and goodbye.